Hi, folks. It's Scott from buyandselldvc.com. Have you ever thought of giving your family a lifetime of Disney vacations? What if we told you you can lock in today's rate for the next 50 years? Again, that's buyandselldvc.com.
Hello, welcome to the Dub D Dub Review. I'm your host, Chris Malik, and I'm joined by a really good friend. You've heard him before. He's our favorite baritone. He's our host emeritus, our lead researcher, Tim Van Swole. Tim, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
Doing good, buddy. We're doing a morning recording, and I've got a little bit of Starbucks Sumatra in the cup. What do you got in your cup today?
Just my favorite old, actually, no, today I've got, I hijacked a K-cup from my Disney hotel room when we were down there last week for the anniversary blend.
Nice.
So it's okay.
A 50th anniversary blend from Joffrey's. Nice.
Yeah.
So we appreciate you joining us today. We're gonna do a little bit of research today and present you a topic that's going to be both interesting and semi-controversial at the same point, not from our perspective, but from a historical perspective. So we're going to talk about an unbuilt resort, park, golf course, pretty much everything that almost occurred right outside of Washington, D.C., and it's called Disney's America. So we've done some research, and we want to give you some information on it. But before we talk about the show, Tim, hit me up. What do you got good in your life, buddy?
I'm excited. We've got my youngest son's high school graduation party this coming weekend. Really looking forward to that, trying to get things ready. It's all college prep stuff in this house right now. As I sit here, I'm looking at piles of boxes of Amazon things, towels and sheets and things, and it's exciting. So looking forward to that. And then going to be getting together with a group of Chicagoland Edcot people, July 3rd. So I'm really excited about that. That'll be fun.
Yeah. It's always cool when we can get together and the people that live within this similar proximity, we don't do that enough just because family, life, work, it's hard. You know, it's not the same way as you get responsibilities added to the plate. It's just really hard to break away and get that. But when we finally put those dates together, it's really pretty cool.
Yes.
So outstanding.
And I'm excited because we both researched the same topic this time. So this will be to be continued from our last adventure. So,
right. So what Tim's referring to, if you go back, I would say, I don't have the exact episode, but if you go back a dozen or so episodes, Tim researched and I researched separate topics for our last DSI, our Dub Scene Investigation is what we've dubbed this. And so we learned about America Sings, but we were trying to research Disney's America. But anyways, like Ghostbusters, you know, we didn't cross the streams. And then, so anyways, here we go.
We'll get two good shows out of it. Well, right? This one's to be determined still, but I think we'll be all right.
Right. So before we start, you know, we thought we would do an introduction along this line. So if you've researched anything to deal with Disney recently, you see there's an overabundance of support and love by the Disney community. But there's also this vitriol and this hostility towards the Disney company, using terms like woke and, you know, throwing around, you know, horrendous ideologies like Disney is setting up kids and parents for these weird relationships and whatnot. And of course, if you're listening, you're probably a Disney supporter and a Disney fan. But, you know, we realize while we're researching Disney's America today, there are some subjects that are touched on that are very controversial. And we realize the parallel between that and this Disney slash woke ideology. And it's kind of a microcosm for America and for really the time right now, where you can literally find any subject and you can pull snippets of information and you can bend them to any thought that you want and use that to strengthen your thought, whether it's true, whether it's relevant, whether honestly it's honest at this point. And that helps strengthen your argument. I honestly don't get it. For Disney being the largest company, Tim, you made a point to say this earlier. They have a target on their back. And this topic today is going to show that as well, too. There are some really good ideas that would have occurred in this project. And there were some ones that were probably cringeworthy and probably not such a great idea as well. But Disney being a major corporation, it's easy to target the company for a number of reasons. You're not going to really get a response from the company, and it helps strengthen whatever you want to say. But just realize that not everything you see in social media or in the news is accurate. And there's oftentimes a platform behind that that's pushing that agenda, which is askew for any number of reasons. So, I just thought it was worth stating that before we actually talk about this project that was unbuilt.
Yeah, I have a hard time, like I said a little when we were talking off the air, the Disney rating system, for example, or the movie rating system in this country, it's broken. It's before a movie has even come out, there's going to be people on either side of it that are putting out fake reviews to push their agenda one way or the other, and it's just, and Disney seems to get more than its fair share of the detractors. And I just don't understand it. It's everywhere, but there's just immediate hate towards Disney that people just want to take down anything they're doing. And I don't get that, but I mean, I have plenty of critiques of Disney. I just came from.
I was going to say that. Correct. Not everything is Pollyanna for us for Disney, because there are several things which we know can be improved or should be changed. And we're not afraid to say that. So we will not view everything Disney does with rose-colored glasses. That will not exist. But it just seems the immediate response is too sharp. Anyways, that being said, let's talk about this project today. So, Tim, I know you did some research. I did some research. This is fascinating because we almost had a Disney park in the northern part of the country, right outside of Washington, D.C. So let's go through the entire process. Where does this start? How does this begin?
Well, it kind of all got its start really in early January 1990. Michael Eisner was the CEO at the time. I wouldn't call him a new CEO because he technically started, I think, in 1984. But in 1990, he made an announcement of the Disney Decade, and they were going to, their intention with the Disney Decade was to just expand Disney parks, at home. They wanted to expand what was going on here, especially Disneyland. That was when they planned the second gate that turned into California Adventure eventually. They were planning on, this was when they were working on Euro Disney over in France. So they wanted to expand at home and abroad their parks. And that was a really exciting concept, but they quickly found out that that was not going to be as easy as they thought. Costs were skyrocketing. There, if you're a historian at all of the Disney company, you know that Euro Disney was a disaster right from the start. It had to be saved later on. It was bleeding money. So they decided that by the summer of 1991, it was the Disney Decade concept was needing to be revamped a little bit. They were scaling back their plans, but they still wanted to do stuff. So they started to think, what can we do that might be a little bit more cost effective and yet somehow expand our footprint on the world of Disney parks? And so in that summer of 1991, Dick Nunes, who was an original cast member at Disneyland, and he eventually became the president of Disney's Outdoor Recreation Division, and he was at the time a pretty powerful board member on the Disney board. He got the idea that, let's think about Colonial Williamsburg. Let's go look at that. Maybe that's something we could take over. And so he convinced Michael Eisner and Frank Wells to go on a trip with him to Virginia and look at Colonial Williamsburg and see what they thought of that.
So before we even get too far along this line, you mentioned Michael Eisner, and if you're a Disney historian, you have kind of a love-hate relationship with some of the things that Michael Eisner did. When he was brought in it was not a great time of success for Disney. The reason why they brought in an outside executive, he was the head of Paramount Studios, was because Disney was struggling. And he had some innovative ideas. You know, he really, you know, we think of Bob Iger as, man, he did all these acquisitions in Star Wars. But, you know, some of the credit actually is due to Michael Eisner when you think he purchased ABC and he purchased ESPN and he built resort expansions. He built resorts and he built, you know, it was a rapid growth period. And in many ways, he was a visionary and he might have been the man needed at that time. So it may be worth us talking about Michael Eisner on a different show.
Yeah.
For all the good and the bad. But yeah, so I just wanted to at least mention that at this point. But this was another project of, hey, there we go, rapid expansion. Let's think about how we can go and expand our footprint.
Right. And it was, as we'll kind of allude to later on, it was really a partnership of Eisner and Wells that was successful. Michael Eisner by himself.
Correct. You're correct.
Wasn't as successful. Frank Wells was able to keep him reined in, but yet be supportive of Eisner's ideas. He was the realistic guy. Eisner was the visionary and the dreamer, but Wells could support that while keeping him reined in from doing something ridiculous.
And that was part of the issue as Frank Wells died suddenly.
Right.
So without the counterpart in that relationship, it led to eventually the downfall. So
exactly.
I'm sorry. I interrupted you. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Okay. So they go on this trip to Williamsburg. And another thing about Eisner is if it was his idea, he was 100% behind it. At this point, it's not his idea. This Williamsburg thing is Dick Nunes's idea, but he's a powerful person in the company. So he's, you know, humoring him. But the trip did result in Eisner kind of getting intrigued by the whole idea of a historical educational park for the Disney company. So it turned out that Williamsburg itself was not going to be a good acquisition. The strategic planning group at Disney, which was kind of a little microcosm of a little powerful group that had maybe undue influence over some things and had their own agendas as well. They said no. You know, they said yes to a lot of crazy ideas during that time period, but they said no to acquiring Colonial Williamsburg. And probably it turned out to be a good thing, but they just felt it was too far out of the way. The whole idea was with Williamsburg was that it was close to Washington, D.C. They wanted to kind of tap into that travel industry of the Washington, D.C. Travelers and draw them in and add another attraction that would be on your agenda if you went on a D.C. trip. Williamsburg was just too far out to really fit that agenda. Mm-hmm. And they felt that it was too seasonal to be a feasible business. Virginia has winter. So they didn't, you know, feel like that was going to be as good of a fit for them. So Williamsburg was put aside, but then they started the idea of like, well, what can we do? Let's try to find something in this vein and make it happen.
Gotcha. The seasonality is always one of the things that, well, every theme park has struggled with. That's when Disney was going to build their prospective resort in St. Louis back when Disney was negotiating and Augusta Bush was there and whatnot. It was undercover because St. Louis has winter and it's, you know, in Chicago, St. Louis is 300 miles south, but we're talking winter 4 months a year. It definitely impacts, you know, your revenue bottom line.
So. Right. All right. So after they return from this trip, they tasked one of their employees, Peter Rummel, and the Disney development team to begin scouting alternate locations for a park of this type in the Washington, D.C. area. And they quickly identified a place near Haymarket, Virginia, as an ideal location where they could get some land. There was a chunk of land that was owned by Exxon at the time, ExxonMobil, that they hadn't, whatever they were going to do with it hadn't panned out. And so it was kind of available. So there was a big chunk of land available there. I want to say it was like 1,000-2,000 acres or something like that, that they felt like they could get. And there was a lot of surrounding land around that area. So they identified that as a really good place. It was good proximity to Washington, D.C. and lots of available land. So they quickly identified that and began very similar to the Walt Disney World project when they, you know, tried to secretly buy up land for the Florida project. It's kind of the approach that they took again here. They started sending people to acquire land under mysterious names, you know. So I heard in one story that I read in my research that there was one Disney employee that was masquerading as a Phoenix businessman, and he was going around and acquiring and trying to do business to acquire all these different chunks of land, and people would take him to the airport. He'd actually go to like the terminal for the Phoenix flight, and then after they left, he would like go to the Los Angeles terminal wherever for his actual flight. He was having to constantly do research and get Phoenix newspapers because he was afraid that somebody might ask him questions about something that was going on in Phoenix. He wouldn't be aware of it, and his cover would be blown. So they really got in the secret, you know.
Of course. And the reason for that, like the Florida project, is once the idea and once the knowledge is out that Disney's buying up massive chunks of land, the neighboring land or that land itself, the price goes through the roof.
Right.
So to buy these on the sly is part of the reason. As I understand it, they held options or purchased nearly 3,000 acres is the number that I've researched. So we have a massive chunk of property just outside of Washington, D.C., correct him?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay.
So now we're on to January 1993. Michael Eisner meets with Imagineering, a select group of people in Imagineering. Again, they're trying to keep this as secret as possible. Bob Weiss was an Imagineer. He was going to be the one that would oversee the project. Eisner wanted it built around a small number of emotionally stirring and heartwarming stories based on important themes of American history. So that was his charge to this Imagineering team. Emotional, heartwarming, but important historical stories. So you gotta meet all those criteria for whatever you're going to put in this. So they started to propose some different ideas for quote unquote lands. They ended up, you know, instead of using lands like in their typical Disney parks, they ended up using the term territories later on. About what can we put in here? There were some ideas thrown around early on about the creation of the Constitution, the Native American experience, a story centered around slavery, the painful creation and birth of the United States in general. So they were throwing out all kinds of ideas, but this was just in the very early stages of brainstorming.
But we already have subjects here, which when you use the words heartwarming, you know, when you discuss American history, if you go to the American Adventure, you often leave there with a patriotic feeling and you enjoy their perception of, but you know, you realize it is a glossed overview. You're talking concepts like Civil War and slavery, and you're talking, you know, other issues like the Native Americans and potentially you need an accurate perception of these situations in American history. They don't often lend themselves to heartwarming situations. So, you know, let's just put a pin in that and stick that over in one corner as we're discussing this later on today.
Exactly.
So, okay.
So up to now, they've been very successful in keeping this whole project a secret. And as you said, for understandable reasons, business-wise, you want to keep the cost of the land down because you keep your costs of the project down. And anybody that finds out Disney's buying is going to jack up the price. So they had to do that from a business sense, but that was going to backfire on them in other ways, the secretiveness of this. And by the fall of 1993, information began to leak out about Disney's involvement. People knew that there was something going on, but they didn't know it was Disney. Eisner was getting support from the outgoing governor in Virginia, as well as the incoming governor in Virginia. He found out that that information was leaking, and so they began to feel pressure to get the announcement out there. They didn't want people to think, they didn't want people to use their imaginations about what was going on, good or bad, and when they felt pressure to get a public announcement. So the plan was in November 11th, it was the initial plan. He called the incoming governor that ironically was at Disney World at the moment that he actually called him. So that was a good omen for Eisner. Both threw their support behind it. Both planned to be at the public announcement on November 11th. So,
right. And we should state, before this announcement actually hit, it's not like this area was devoid of tourism. Mm-mm. Or tourist attractions. The reason it was selected was it's a major hub, you know, the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area. I mean, you're talking things like King's Dominion, Busch Gardens, all within a reasonable time frame of this. You know, Jamestown, Yorktown, Colonial Williamsburg, the National Air and Space Museum, and every Washington, D.C. attraction itself. So, I mean, it's a major tourist hub of the country. But as you'll talk about later on, the proximity to actual Civil War battlefields and historical sites was part of the issue. I think we're gonna discuss later on too with this.
Exactly, and the good and the bad of the situation was that it was located. This parcel of land was located just off of Interstate 66, which would be good for bringing people into there. But the negative was that there was concern that it wasn't going to be adequate. Traffic flow, that there was Interstate 66 needed to be expanded anyway.
Heck, we can't get I-4 correct him at this point, you know?
Exactly.
So, okay.
Exactly. So anyway, so they planned this press conference for November 11th. November 8th, the Wall Street Journal runs a very vague story about Disney opening up a park in Virginia. No details, nothing of any. Just enough to get some excitement going for the people. So, but that happens on November 8th. November 10th, the Washington Post then runs a much more detailed article leaking a lot of details about Disney's plans. And the tone was set in that initial article by the Washington Post that their position throughout this whole process is going to be critical and not supportive of the Disney project. So so that created a bigger problem for Disney. Some of the examples that they listed in this opposition in this initial article were that it was close to the Manassas Civil War battlefield that you just alluded to. Mm-hmm. Two major battles of the Civil War had been fought on that land, and it was very close to that. There were also this area of Virginia was an area where a lot of wealthy, powerful local landowners had their private retreats, and they didn't want them near their, you know, they didn't want to take their seclusion away. They wanted their private retreats to remain their private retreats. And then, as I said a little bit ago, the fear of traffic congestion and also the pollution that would come along with that, those were all concerns that Washington Post posed in that initial conversation or an article.
The Disney company and Michael Eisner were frankly surprised at the public opposition to this project. They felt for the jobs that be created, the tax benefits to the state, that there was very little downside to this project. But all of a sudden, there was a lot of public opposition. They had historians, they had governmental support and governmental, you know, anger at the project. You know, one of the things they were suggesting was, you know, Disney's America would be like, this is from David McCullough, said a commercial blitzkrieg on what was American history and a golden version and in you know, a selective overview of these topics, and that we felt that maybe Civil War shouldn't be taught by Mickey and Minnie Mouse. And Michael Eisner was frankly surprised. It was quoted, and I'm going to paraphrase, that he thought he'd be put on people's shoulders and carried around for what he could bring to that area and to the country, as he sat in many history classes. And frankly, he was bored with the history that was given to mm-hmm. him. And here it'd be through cartoons, movies, rides, experiences, foods, stories, every type of sense you can put your hands on to teach you American history.
Right.
So I don't know if they accurately thought out, or at least I don't know if they felt the opposition was fair, but it was plentiful. There was quite a bit.
The thing is, I think the general population of people in Virginia were very supportive. I don't know that I would say that the opposition was plentiful, but it was powerful.
That's a good term. Correct.
They had the right people opposing them. So your average Joe Schmo person, you know, in Virginia, they were all excited about it. Yeah, bring Disney to me. It's going to make it easier for me to take my family to Disney. The government was behind it, but the people that opposed it had the right platforms. They had the right power. One of the people that I heard talking about this referred to it as class warfare. You know, one of the things that they brought up was concern that, well, the people working at Disney are going to be working for, you know, minimum wage, the people that are going to work at this project. And the average people there are saying, well, what do you think we are here? What population of people do you think live here? We're blue collar people. We're working for minimum wage. Gotcha. That's not a bad thing. That brings jobs to us that are available for us.
Now, Tim, when you say powerful people, you're right. They use the accurate statements, and they use some really good statements to go and solidify their arguments. Things like, remember we put the pin in the word slavery up above, and we're going to pull that pin down for a second. So, you know, groups that were concerned that historical events like the Civil War and slavery could be potentially trivialized. And things like, well, we're going to sell souvenirs of any variety, but they use words like souvenir slavery ships, things along those lines. That's a very, you know, powerful, evocative statement, and one that honestly is polarizing when you hear things like that. So they knew the buttons to push to go and provide the correct opposition to this.
Yeah, we'll come back to the negative opposition a little bit, but. When the actual press conference took place, I think I got November 11th and November 12th. So I don't know if one of them had the date wrong or if maybe the press conference got pushed back a day. I don't have the details on that. But on 11th or 12th of November, they had the actual press conference, and it was held in Manassas, Virginia. And Bob Weiss and Michael Eisner presented artist renderings and scale model of the park. And they outlined the different territories that they were going to have at this park. All right, so now we're going to take a few minutes, and we're going to actually kind of outline what the names of the different territories and what they were planning on including in the park. At least this is their initial plan, which would, with any plan, things get altered. But, excuse me, this is initially what they were going to include. So the first territory was going to be Native America. So a Native American experience. This would cover the era of the year 1600 to approximately 1810 in American history. And so this is a territory where you would explore the life of Native Americans, the people who were there initially, the people who actually were there before Christopher Columbus discovered America, quote unquote, discovered. You would be able to visit an Eastern tribe's Indian village that they were going to build a replica of there. This project is the one that just won't go away. The Lewis and Clark raft expedition. They couldn't get in the St. Louis project. Let's try to ram it in here. So they were going to have a Lewis and Clark raft expedition. And this is also the time when Pocahontas was getting its release in the Disney movie world. And so their immediate thoughts were, you know, possible Pocahontas tie-in in this area, which that's, you know, as we all know, Pocahontas is exactly the kind of example of what a lot of these historians that were oppositions or opposed to this, that's the kind of things that they were concerned about. Like this is a Disney-fied version of the history. Mm-hmm. And so, but anyway, so that was going to be the Native American experience. Another territory was President's Square from 1750 to 1800 would be the years for this. This would be an area to celebrate democracy and the patriots who had fought for independence, to gain independence and to keep independence. It would also probably have included a relocated Hall of Presidents. It would probably have taken Hall of Presidents out of Magic Kingdom and relocated it to this park in Virginia. It was also going to include an outdoor amphitheater where they could do live shows and demonstrations and things.
It's an interesting perspective to go through these as a themed area based on timing of the country, as opposed to, you know, a named version, a fantasy land, a frontier land, you know, type of situation. So interesting perspective to go and break these sections up based on, you know, years.
Yep. All right. So the next one was going to be called Crossroads USA. This would be covering the time period of approximately 1800 to 1850. It was a portrayal of mid-19th century commerce, similar to what Main Street USA would be like. So it was going to be a kind of a Main Street USA experience. They would also include steam train rides around the park. And this was going to have a mid-19th century themed hotel within the park as well, in this section. So that was Crossroads USA.
Which is interesting because there's not any example of that actually, other than having just a few views from, in California, from the Grand Californian Inn, but interesting perspective to have it actually in the park.
Yeah. So the next one was Civil War Fort, 1850 to 1870. They would have used their Circle Vision 360 technology to have a film that they claimed that they were going to try to transport visitors into the center of a Civil War battlefield. So they were going to make it feel like you're in the midst of a Civil War battle. They also plan to have authentic reenactments going on in different areas of this section. They also planned a nighttime spectacular. You got to have a nighttime spectacular, right? Featuring a recreation of the battle between the ironclad ships, the Merrimack and the Monitor from the Civil War. The battle that actually took place, that was kind of the beginning of the Civil War, the first actual combat between the Confederate and the Union armies. So that was, I don't know how you make that a nighttime spectacular, but that was their plan.
Tim, so you could almost start to see some of these ideas that in theory and on paper sound like reasonable ideas to go and educate. But you could almost see how the version of this is like, you kind of scratch your head and like, I'm not so sure how to pull that off both educationally and heartwarming. Right. You know, everyone's history, America's history, it doesn't follow those lines necessarily. So yeah, this is going to be an interesting perspective, but it might not be what they think it's going to be. You know,
the history teacher in me loves the whole idea. Like, I'm always trying to come up with crazy ideas to make something more interesting.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean every idea that comes into my head is going to work, or that it you know, sometimes I do things and I'm going, that was dumb.
Yeah. Just because you can doesn't mean you should at this point. Correct. Okay.
But this isn't expensive. I can do that on a much cheaper scale and learn my lesson. Disney can't afford to make those kinds of mistakes.
Correct. The nighttime spectacular of the Monitor and the mayor. Yeah.
It's a little cringy.
Okay.
But it could have been cool. I don't know. Lots of fireworks from the explosions. I don't know.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So, all right. So 1870 to 1930, this is going to be a territory called the We the People. It would be a building that would be resembling Ellis Island. And it would celebrate the immigrant heritage of the United States. Later on, this wasn't in this initial press conference, but fairly soon after this, they actually included, and here's the cringy part again, they decided that they might have plans for featuring the Muppets explaining the immigrant experience. So I don't know if it's cringy, but it definitely gives fuel to the fire of the people that are saying, you're just going to gloss over this. Like Muppets telling the story. I love the Muppets, but, and yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
There you go. You want your American history and the immigrant experience conveyed by Fozzie.
Yeah.
And Gonzo.
So. And later plans for this turned it into, it was going to be a like half ride, half Muppet story. So I don't know exactly how that was going to pan out, but, yeah, so the Muppets would be telling the story of immigrants in America.
I'm not saying it can't be done, though. I'm not saying that it can't be done in a cool version of that. And so I guess it depends on the, you know, what you're looking for through there. But I'm not saying it couldn't be done. No. And actually, that may be a conduit, you know, as opposed to being too sensitive, is having it portrayed by the Muppets.
Right.
So
it's going to be a polarizing thing for the people that want it to be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, remember what we said about pulling what you want from any statement to go and strengthen your argument. But
exactly, that's exactly right. All right, next territory, Enterprise. This is going to be.
Tim, I'm sorry. I keep on thinking of Waka 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 as we're going along through. I'm sorry. I just can't. All right. Here we go.
Yeah. All right. That'd be great. All right. So Enterprise, this is a time period. They have some of these overlaps. So also from 1870 to 1930, they're going to be featuring the territory of Enterprise, featuring the factory town of Enterprise. And it would be portraying the inventions and innovations of the Industrial Revolution in this area. It would include like a high-speed adventure through a turn-of-the-century steel mill, culminating in a narrow escape from a vat of molten steel. So,
okay. So at this time period, in terms of labor and labor forces, also controversial, you know, as far as, you know, wages, as far as ages, working in factories and whatnot. But in theory, though, you know what? There was a time period of awesome innovation, you know, as you look at the world fairs and what the world fairs were able to present in those, you know, small windows and snippets of time.
Right.
So that really sounds pretty interesting to me. That sounds pretty fascinating. I'm not so sure about the blast furnace thing going on there, but pretty interesting.
The narrow mm-hmm. escape from a molten steel. It's like, well, that's great, but that just makes you, on a historical level, you realize like, oh, well, there are plenty of people that didn't escape from molten steel. That's the real historical takeaway from here. Not like, woohoo, everybody survived. No, they didn't.
Yeah.
So, Victory Field was going to be the next territory from 1930 to 1945. They didn't really have a fully developed concept at this time, and you could kind of sense it. That they were kind of still like, we're not sure what we're going to do with this, but they had to mention it. So it would emphasize the importance of manned flight and the impact of, you know, the Wright brothers on the development of military advancements that had occurred in this time or in the history. It may have included the use of technology to simulate parachuting from a plane or operating tanks and weapons in battle. So
from what I gathered in a few of the videos and that I read, essentially it was, they're trying to have people experience what America's soldiers faced during the world wars, either through aircraft or whatnot. One of the pieces that I found really interesting is one of the potential projects was going to be a simulator where you would feel the experience of flying in various American aircrafts. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar where you're essentially flying, through American. Yeah. It got potentially moved around and repurposed and currently exists as a Soarin' attraction.
Right.
So yeah, that was the precursor for that.
Also covering the same time period, would be another territory from 1930 to 1945. State Fair was the theme of this one. It would be celebrating nostalgic small town American America at play. This would be more of your typical kind of carnival. They would include a 60 foot Ferris wheel, a classic wooden roller coaster, and they were going to somehow include a tribute to baseball that they had described an experience that almost sounded like a Field of Dreams kind of thing where you would, it would probably be holograms or animatronics or something where you would go in and sit down in a baseball field surrounded by cornfields and, sit there eating a hot dog while watching some of the famous players from the past participate and play a baseball game. So not sure how they were going to pull that off, but that was part of the plan.
And we have one more, correct, about the farm. Is that correct, Tim?
Yes, Family Farm was the last. So also 1930 to 1945, this was going to be an homage to the working farm. So you'd be able to see how crops were harvested, how to make homemade ice cream, how to milk a cow, participate in a country. This almost sounds like Hoop-Dee-Doo review kind of thing. You would be able to participate in a country wedding and a barn dance and a buffet that would kind of go along with that. So
sure feels like parts of the land pavilion at this yeah. point.
Yeah, exactly. So a mashup of Hoopty Doo and The Land. There mm-hmm. you go. That doesn't sound like such a bad idea. So,
All right. What happened? What happened?
So the presentation seemed to have gone pretty well. It met Eisner's guidelines. The project at this point seems cost effective. The estimated cost of the project at this point was about $650 million, which was less than Epcot had cost. So, and it seemed to be pretty well received by the general public. However, at the end of the presentation, Bob Weiss took the microphone and he addressed the crowd. And he explained that this was not going to be a Pollyanna portrayal of America. He went on to say that they wanted to make people feel what it was like to be a Civil War soldier, to escape the Underground Railroad, and what it was like to be a slave. Mm-hmm. And that was the real cringe moment of, ooh, that might be what you're going for, but that was not the way to say it. This was a pretty big blunder in the PR process of this whole project.
Okay.
So rather than the sense of people walking away with the sense that, hey, Disney brings history to life, critics attacked the plans on a basis of, well, you're being presumptuous about what it was like to be these people. You're going to presume that you understand what a slave experienced and what their how they felt. And that did a lot of damage to this whole project.
Correct. And Eisner would later disavow those comments, saying that Weiss had misspoken. And yeah. and was not used to speaking to the media.
Right.
And,
he's not our public relations guy. So
Correct.
Yeah. But the more they tried to get out of their own way, the more they stepped on their own toes. The damage was done. And there was critics from the start. There were people that were just looking for these nuggets to jump on, and they gave it to them.
Correct.
So that may have been the beginning of the end of this project. Spoiler alert, it doesn't happen. So, but that may have been the beginning of the end right there. But they didn't give up on it. Michael Eisner at this point, as I said earlier, when he got behind an idea, he was 100%, he was like a mad dog going after it. He wasn't going to give up easily. And so he didn't. So, The portion of the press conference where they addressed questions of environmental concerns was actually handled pretty well, but it was 2 days or too late. About 5 days later, you had a group of wealthy landowners from the area that met to organize their opposition. You had environmental groups that were already expressing concerns about, you know, like water. This area is in a watershed to the Chesapeake Bay, and you have wildlife living in these areas, and they were putting together their projects. And then the people from the historical side of things, they got some very powerful people. You already mentioned David McCullough. They got Shelby Foote, who is probably, you know, one of the most well-known Civil War writers. Later there was a group, I don't remember the name of the group, but the people put together a group of historians that included Doris Kearns Goodwin, who was a pretty famous, well-known historical writer as well. Just got a lot of people behind the opposition from a historical standpoint, too. So there were like three different groups.
And Disney's countering this by stating that, you know, we're going to be we're creating 12,000 jobs. We are going to create $14.1 million in annual tax revenue for the state. So Disney's trying to, you know, bestow the virtues of what they can do. But, you know, both of these sides are meeting some pretty big, you know, hurdles as they're trying to push their case forward at this point.
Right. And that's the good news in this situation. And the New York Times was kind of an ally in that. They were producing this information, those statistics that you just mentioned about the financial stuff. But at the same time, this is when Euro Disney, all the news about Euro Disney just being a disaster and that Disney is bleeding money into that project was going on as well, which hurt their credibility a little bit because Disney had, you know, proclaimed that Euro Disney was going to be this great thing. And now look at what's happening. They're telling us that the Virginia project's going to be great. But what if it's the same situation? So that wasn't helping their circumstances either. Gotcha. Despite the opposition, Imagineering continued to press on. They were scheduling multiple trips to DC by different people and surrounding areas. They kind of tasked different subgroups with, like, all right, you're going to research the baseball experience. You're researching the Native American experience. So they kind of were secretive trips to go out there and try to get more information. But it was a top secret situation. They had a whole area of Imagineering that was designated for this part of the project that other Imagineers didn't even know existed. It had been like a condemned area of the building in Burbank, and this is where they were working on the project. So it was like covert operations on people going forward with this. sorry, find my place here. The winter of 1993 edition of WDI, so W, capital D, and the word I, like EYE. This was Imagineering's internal publication. And this had some really informative stuff. So Bob Weiss was laying out a plan for the Virginia project and explaining that it was unlike anything that Disney had ever done. And it was not to be compared to Walt Disney World and Disneyland or any other project, because this is different than anything we've done. So don't get hung up on comparing apples and oranges. It addressed real issues. It said that they were going to address real issues, that it was going to address a diverse population, and it was going to be a mix of entertainment and education.
And all in an attempt to go over America's history at this point.
Yes, exactly.
So what happened, Tim? How did this not, or let's say, how did this project come to a hesitation or a stop?
So it kind of, so they had a target opening at this point of 1998, and Eisner convened an all-day meeting to explain to the people the need to refine and stabilize the plans, because it wasn't going well. He told Imagineers that the most difficult job would be to tell the important story of history, let me read my quote here. He told Imagineers the most difficult job won't be to tell important stories of history or to deliver an enjoyable experience. It will be to do both. And I'm not sure that was possible, but that was their plan. They began looking more critically at this after getting some feedback from some of their critics. They removed the roller coaster idea from the Industrial Revolution for fear of trivializing the real steel mill experience. Mm-hmm. By the end of the day, Eisner was really more convinced than ever that this was the right thing to do. And he had the support of Virginians in general, but he still had all those different things. It all kind of started to fall apart when Frank Wells, as you mentioned earlier, died in a helicopter accident in April of 1994. Frank was kind of his heir that kept him going. Mm-hmm. And he lost his partner. And so that led to some problems. And then in the aftermath of Frank Wells dying, Jeffrey Katzenberg came in as kind of one of Eisner's lieutenants, and they were in a power grab situation, a power struggle there. Eisner ends up going to Washington, D.C., and he's testifying before a Senate subcommittee on the use of public lands. These hearings were broadcast on CNBC, so they were public, and he had a lot of concern about the negativity that was going to possibly be taken away from people seeing him testify in this area. And he was called to this because of Disney's Virginia project being located so close to Manassas battlefields. He also agreed to a sit down interview with a member of the Washington Post. He knew that he couldn't avoid meeting with his critics, but he definitely went into that interview with a chip on his shoulder. And that came across mm-hmm. in his interview, that he had a chip on his shoulder. He was very defensive. And the article that came out as a result of that interview was very much not flattering of Disney or the whole project. And so even though he comes out of that experience going to Washington, when he met with Washington Post and he testified to the subcommittee, the government was still behind it. He was very much 100% sure that the federal government was not going to interfere with this.
Because it's a private land project, right? It's a private project at this point.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he felt like, all right, there's a lot of opposition, but we can still do this. Nobody's going to stop us from doing it. But about a month later, Michael actually underwent a quadruple bypass surgery. So the stress of the whole process was getting to him, losing wells, going through this constant dealing with this situation, probably just exaggerated the heart problem that he probably already had. In August, I think that was in July. So in August, then a new financial projection report came out about their revised projections about how this project was going to go or what it was going to do, because they keep having to delay it for various reasons. And the costs were continuing to rise. Some of the projections even showed that the park could be operating at a loss because they were going to have to put a lot of money into combating the opposition. So that was an additional cost. Eisner considered just revamping the whole project and trying to scale it back, but knew that if they do that, that's going to take away from the whole experience anyway. In the end, he finally just realized, like, with my health and with the circumstances of the company and the opposition, just we're just going to put an end to the project. And so he ended it.
And they ended it in late September of 94. They announced they would not build the America's theme park near Manassas, despite the political backing of the officials.
Yes. So that, but some of those projects did end up, some of the ideas did make their way into, you know, other areas of the park. So for instance, in California Adventure, they did end up building things. You mentioned Soarin' was going to be similar, is kind of a takeaway from one of the ideas about the flying thing. Condor Flats, I think, was another one. Became Grizzly Peaks Airfield, Paradise Pier. They built Paradise Pier. It was going to be kind of a state fair sort of experience. They built Condor Flats. So there were a lot of things that they included in, like, California Adventure and other parts of their plans. But I think it's interesting to note that all the things that they took from that original plan and included in California Adventure, none of those exist anymore. So had they built this park, would it have had the staying power?
It's worth mentioning that before the project was shelved entirely, they did do that conceptual study and they did try and salvage the project. It literally lasted for weeks. That's it. Until the project was officially pulled and they said, we're out. But it was a different version. It was no longer an accurate historical version of what America's history would be. Things like democracy and the land and creativity and fun and service and sacrifice. Streets of America, which is like dining from Chicago, LA, New Orleans, New York, St. Louis, San Francisco. So there was a generic's not the wrong word, but it was a lesser version of the park. And they realized, based upon those circumstances and his health, okay, it's just not worth it at this point. That's not what the intent was. So there was a version that actually was proposed or conceptualized, but like in the shortest conceptualization ever, it lasted for weeks. That was it. So,
and there was still public sentiment that the people wanted this. One article that I read said that soon after they announced that they were ending the Virginia project, a group of people in Pennsylvania reached out to Eisner and to Disney and said, hey, we want to put together a plan for you possibly to do this here.
In North Carolina and Maryland as well, too. So there were other places that said, wait a minute, this is not a bad idea. We can make this work. So one of the things I think that they struggled with, too, was I don't know if you found the information, Tim, but when they initially thought about the climate, they had a potential park closure for 2 months initially. They were thinking there'd be a park closure for 2 months, but they realized based on weather patterns, it was going to be longer than 2 months. Mm-hmm. They had it closed for up to as much as 4 months a year. And you could imagine tacking those additional 2 months onto a 4 month closure. We're talking a third of the year at this point.
Yeah.
And that was part of the, you know, the issue, you know, the revenue and return on that as well. But it didn't mean it was dead. You know, these ideas kind of stay around and they linger forever. So at this point still, you know, we're still talking, you know, over in California, we're still talking about potential expansion there. Right. So right. This is going to branch off into a couple of different conversations as we go along. So this might be the first time we introduce the idea of something called Westcott to people, which is exactly how it sounds. It is essentially a second gate in California, and it's a Western, not Western as you think, but like Western part of the country version of Epcot, featuring Spaceship Earth. And they're thinking about second gates, right? So we're talking about how do we get additional property over there. But back to the original Disney's America, there's a park in California that at the time was for sale. And it's not located close to Disneyland. It's in California, honestly, three blocks away is 20 minutes. You know, if you've ever been to California, that's just the time period. But Knott's Berry Farm was for sale. But the history between the Disney company and the family that owned Knott's Berry Farm, it wasn't all great. But the reason that they were really interested was we have a working version of Independence Hall right now. They have it over at Knott's Berry Farm. Ooh, that's really interesting. We could do something with this and expand that project. So there was a thought, okay, let's bring some of those concepts and ideas over to California. Let's maybe consider purchasing Knott's Berry Farm. But through discussions, through how, you know, the family felt, they didn't want a Disney version or a change to their park, that sale was squashed. So that idea really never died. And in fact, you know, it currently still even exists. Good ideas really never die. Bad ideas should be dead. Yeah. but good ideas are cannibalized. And that's where you got Soarin' and Grizzly River Rapids and all these things. But there also exists an idea for, you know, further expansion. There's been rumors of it forever. But yeah, it still exists in the shelves, you know, of Disney Imagineering.
Yeah. I think Disney needs to probably focus on expanding, you know, popular crowd eaters at their existing parks right now is probably where their time should be better spent. But that's another issue.
That is another issue. And that's where after the sale of Knott's Berry Farm, based on logistics, travel, distance, things along those lines, that's where really California Adventure, you know, really picked up steam and that became a reality as these places entered in there. So, Tim, what was the thing that surprised you most about researching this project? What was something that you really didn't know or something that you thought, eesh, as you researched it?
I there were a lot of various moments, but I really didn't know any of it. I knew that Disney had Disney's America that was going to be in Virginia, and it never happened. It was really what I went into this with. I didn't have any details, so it was all kind of a surprise. You know, I guess the most surprising moment is Walt was so beloved that I don't think he ever got that kind of pushback on any of his projects. It's not that everything went well, but I don't think he got the kind of pushback that they experienced with this project. I think this was kind of a trend or groundbreaking area where Disney got just a lot of hate just because they were Disney. You know, I think it was the other way around. Like, people might be opposed, but they kind of gave a pass to Disney because it was Disney. And now this was the beginning of, no, we don't like Disney because it's Disney, and they're going to do this to whatever we have, even before they saw what was going to happen.
I'd like to say that's 100%. I'm in 100% agreement. I do think some of that came from the proximity to the Manassas National Battlefield as well, too. The historical context can't be overlooked in there. But, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard, you know, it's the word littered is not right, but like it's littered. It's full of historical battlefields, structures, buildings, and just context. Right. You know, in Florida, as you mentioned, you know, Florida, when Disney bought it, Florida was swamp. It's swampland. I mean, the story of the creation of Walt Disney World, you know, there was, you know, obviously there was you know, native people that lived in that area. But a lot of that area was so largely undeveloped that it was like, hey, this is a benefit to the community because there's nothing there right now. It's swampland. But here you're literally parking a park right outside of, you know, a battlefield. So
maybe that was my biggest takeaway. Like, again, as a history teacher, I want to see anything that wants, you know, develops a history in a way that makes it interesting. But ultimately I was left with like, was it needed? You know, what was the purpose for a historical aspect? There's plenty of stuff in Washington, D.C. and around Washington, D.C. to educate you already on the historical experience. It wasn't needed in that area. Whereas Florida had nothing when they built Walt Disney World. It had nothing. So it was needed. They needed something, and it served a purpose. I don't know that putting one more attraction that was going to take, you know, one or two more days from a family that makes their Washington, D.C. trip was necessary. Mm-hmm. So
I struggle to think at how Disney would have pulled off the convergence of both heartwarming but accurate portrayal of America's history, because our history as a country is heartbreaking, and it's brutal and it's painful, and it's progressive as well too, and it's beautiful as well too. But it's difficult to see how those would all come together. I don't know if you could serve both masters in that situation. And I think that's where I think that concept was so far out of the realm of what they have done. People couldn't conceptualize that. They were like, I just can't see this. I don't see how this works. And we feel like the version we're going to get is not going to be accurate. And you know what? It's not without validity, you know? So,
yeah.
But yeah, no, that's fascinating. That's the history of the unbuilt Disney's America. Now, again, Tim and I are very amateur historians and researchers, and it's entirely possible that we may have messed up a date or something. But for the majority, I think it was fairly accurate. Disney's got a lot of history of these unbuilt places. There's a ski resort we haven't talked about that wasn't built. And so, you know, Disney's Westcott that we haven't talked about. So there's a lot more history to discuss. And we look forward to doing that, you know, on the next time, you know. So Tim, you know, I appreciate you doing all that legwork. You know, what an entirely fascinating project. And, you know, I look forward to the next one and can only hope that the next one though deals with less controversial subjects, you know, as this one did.
So, yeah. For sure.
All right. So for listening today, we appreciate it. If you have any feedback or you'd like to send us a comment, please join us both. We're in our Facebook group called EDCOT, E-D-C-O-T, or find us on Facebook on the WW Review Facebook page or on our Instagram page. Reach out to us. Tim, best way to get a hold of you is through EDCOT. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All right. E-D-C-O-T. So for my buddy Tim and for myself, we'd like to thank you. We want to wish you a great day.
Bye, everybody.